Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Beirut Banyan Podcast.
Let's start by giving a round of applause to Rayan, the audio engineer tonight. He can filter us to make us sound better as well. Let's extend the round of applause to Alexi Shadia, the cameraman, a very talented cameraman. Before I start the podcast, this is a special night for me. Special for several reasons. First is, this is a lovely audience for any occasion. I think most of us are friends. A lot of us know each other. But I'm surrounded by love tonight. And that love extends to someone who said yes to an invitation 2 weeks ago to join me on this podcast. I'm a bit nervous, I'm a bit shy, because I'm humbled to be speaking to Christina Passi.
Thank you.
Great episode. Good night. I really don't know where to begin. I thought about this on my way here to kind of make it personal and public. I didn't want to reach out to you after October 13. I wanted to wait to maybe run into you one day and have it a very casual, normal encounter. The way I kind of imagine meeting many people for the first time. And then I got over it. I think it was November, late November. I finally built up the courage to introduce myself to you. And it was the best decision I made. Because for those that don't know Christina, she has dark humor that's darker than mine. The moment I entered AUH, the moment I found your room, all I heard was, Shata! And I'm like, that's her? Shata! Food! I'm like, okay. And I walked in and you're in a room that's really full of love. People there by your side. I think you called it the Ukrainian exchange. Is that right?
Delegation,
right. Relatives and aunt taking care of geopolitical matters in another room. But you were willing to talk to me openly and frankly about a very difficult subject. And you attracted me the moment you started speaking. It's because you're funny. And you're dealing with pain the way I understand it best, which is humor. And I really think humor heals wounds. And you were doing that right in front of me. I was caught off guard. I guess it was 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, I spoke to Maya Jbeli, or actually I produced an episode with Wael Talib, who's at L'Orient Le Jour, with Maya Jbeli. I was in the room behind the camera. And a lot of it had to do with your story in the background. And I want to say thank you for dropping me a message after that episode, because you're really funny. You said, I wanted to be in that episode. And I'm like, we can make that happen. And then you said, kind of, no. And I said, okay, how about next week? And you said, yes, no, wait, it's my birthday. I'm like, okay, the week after. And then you said, okay, Shata. You win. Something along those lines. Anyway, that's my way of getting to know you. I obviously know the tragedy, the way a lot of us observe it. I'll give a shout out to Dylan Collins. He's in the room somewhere.
Yes.
Round of applause to Dylan. I don't want to feel like an imposter. So I'm going to ask you what I think is appropriate. You interject as you see fit. I know a bit about your background. I know that this is a career you chose from day one. I know that your passion for war coverage is real. I know that Patrick Bez, sitting in the front, told you this is not the right job, don't do it. And you said, no, I'm going to do it. And you've done it. So let's go back to that initial passion, where it comes from exactly in the context of Lebanon. Is there a political moment or is there a otherwise non-political moment that made you say that you wanted to be both a photojournalist and in a way a war correspondent?
First of all, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. Of course, it's all political. Having grown up in post-war generation, post the Civil War generation, I lived the consequences of the Civil War. But I was never, like, as every child, I was clueless about the political situation in my country. And my family is secular, so in a way they protected us from this environment. It wasn't until 2005 when I lived the assassination of the former Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri.
Rafi al-Hariri.
So yeah, it was until that moment, I was around 9, 10. I remember I was super scared. I didn't really understand. All I've witnessed is chaos around me, the neighbors, everyone following the news, screaming. As a child, you don't really understand what's happening. Fast forward to 2006. So my parents moved to Qatar. They took us to Qatar for a safer environment. And in 2006, we were visiting Lebanon in the summer, until we got stuck here because of the Israeli war. So I also, like, lived the Israeli war when I was 10, something like that, to 11. Of course, all these, living as a child, these events, they all influenced my decision later on becoming a journalist or a war correspondent. In a way, I felt like when I took the decision to become a journalist, I felt like I understand what people living in a conflict or under war or aggression or any kind of atrocity, what they feel like, what they experience. So I related to that, and I wanted to document. I wanted to be part of that. I wanted my photos to be part of the history and shaping the history. So it wasn't until my last year in uni when I decided to become a photojournalist. I never found my tool in journalism. I never knew what kind of a journalist I want to be exactly. But until I took a photography class, and it blew my mind. It combined photography and journalism at the same time. So I was fascinated, I fell in love, and from there I was so insisting on becoming a photojournalist, even though everyone around me told me not to become a photojournalist as a woman. It's a very male-dominated field, but I was super insisting, which led me to do an internship with Reuters, and that's where I met Aysam in 2018. Yeah, and our friendship grew from there.
So before we get to Aysam and really the last 6 months, almost 6 months to the day, prior to that, your childhood, you're curious about violence, because you're mentioning an assassination and you're young. You're 9 at the time?
9, 10.
A year later, you're still very young. You're a child. The 2006 war is happening around you and your family takes you to Qatar. But I... trying to think of where this inclination to war comes from. Is it that you see it shaping in a way what is otherwise a childhood and interfering with that?
Of course, it shaped my perspective about the world around me. I as a child, I became more curious about what's happening and the news, and I wanted to know the history of Lebanon. So it all led to, one thing led to another, and it opened so many doors.
It sounds like photojournalism is an extension of journalism. It's not photography to begin with.
No, it didn't start as photography at first. Photography, yeah. It was something I discovered in uni, because I didn't like to express myself in writing. So, so yeah, photography, I found out about it when I was in uni because a professor supported me. And that's how, yeah, it became my tool into expressing myself. And I love being behind the camera. I hate being in front of the camera. So yeah, it's just bearing witness of what's happening and like try my best to document and be in the middle of the action.
You're quick to know what you want to do in life. I think that's unusual. It's a gift that you know from the beginning what you want to be. And I'm only going to guess that covering war is one chapter of it, but the passion for photography in itself, is that from watching how other people cover war?
Definitely. It's all related to basically the early 2000s. The entire region had suffered so many big events from war in the Iraq or any other places. So we grew up to these events. We grew up watching the news. And I always felt like I want to be part of that. I want to be part of the ones who are documenting and making history, just like all the great journalists or war correspondents, like Marie Colvin, for example, in Syria. Yeah. I was fascinated by her work. And so many others, that like Joa Silva, for example, who also lost both of his legs in Afghanistan. So many great iconic photojournalists and war correspondents shaped and influenced my decision into being part of these iconic photographers.
So the Syria war is in the background when you're entering university.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know you want to study photojournalism in a sense. Is this where you meet Patrick Baz at university?
Patrick Baz, I was also one of the local people that I was very, very influenced by and by their work for covering the civil war. And I reached out to him, I remember, when graduating, for him to be part of my thesis, which was also about the role of images in shaping our post-war memory. And yeah, that's how we met, and we discussed my future, and our relationship developed from there, and he was a great, great support. And Patrick Baz was also my link to AFP, and in order for me to get the job, my reference.
Right.
So yeah. My career started by having, even though so many people told me not to follow photojournalism and become a photojournalist, I had a great support system as well that helped me reach my dreams and my goals in a way. I still have so many, but yeah, some of them at least.
Going into Reuters, and I understood that this was an internship at the beginning.
Yeah.
And you're meeting somebody who would later become many things to you. And there's a story that you're permanently attached to, which is Aysam Abdullah. If you can take me back to that initial encounter with him as an intern, meeting somebody who's further in his career, obviously, but maybe shaping your career behind the scenes in terms of friendship and support and professional support. So maybe the beginning of that relationship.
Yeah, so when I did my internship in Reuters, Aysam was one of the very, very few people who supported me in my goals and ambitions. We didn't immediately become friends. It took some time to develop this friendship. And even after I moved to Cyprus, we stayed in contact. And he became the kind of person that you'd reached out to whenever you needed help. Ironically, also, Aysam was the person who got me the camera that I was using during the attack, because it was much cheaper to buy it from Lebanon than Cyprus. So there are so many little links. Even though we weren't living in the same country, we were colleagues, we were friends. But yeah, I was super excited to be working alongside him again, since we worked together in Cyprus to cover the Pope visit. And yeah, I remember the day my boss called me and asked me if I want to go to Lebanon. I was above, like, more than excited. And the first person I texted was Aysam, and I sent him a picture of me wearing the flag vest. So, and he was also excited, and he was like, yeah, okay, see you at the border. And yeah.
You leave Reuters and then join AFP.
Yes.
So you're out of the country when October 7 begins.
Yes.
Oh, so you're based in Cyprus, where I guess AFP has their headquarters.
MENA headquarters.
And I hope I remember this right. This is the first time you're covering war in your career.
Yes, this was my first assignment to a conflict zone. However, at first when I was sent, that's the thing, when I was sent, the war wasn't declared. It was just, I was sent to cover what's happening in the Palestinian camps, the situation at the border, the UN patrolling, such stuff, which with my colleague Dylan, we were already covering this stuff the past 2 days before the attack.
So it wasn't meant to go straight to the south. No. You could have been covering...
I was already working on different stuff before.
I see, yeah.
Yeah, until the decision was made for us to be sent to the south, even though so many people and colleagues at work didn't really want me to go, because I'm still young and I don't really have the expertise and experience in such areas. But I was so insisting, and I remember I had like a small argument with the chief, and I was like, please send me, like, I really want to go. And I was super excited also to work alongside Dylan, you know, like, all these people, Dylan, Isam, all these people that I knew of, but I never really got the opportunity to work alongside them as much as I want, because I'm based in Cyprus.
Right. And if you could just, as much as you can say about your job in Cyprus versus being on the field, I can imagine being stuck at a desk job in Cyprus is a nightmare. And this is how I would see it. I don't know if this resonates with you.
It is, of course it is.
Yeah, it's more of a nightmare than being here during war for somebody that wants to be part of the story.
Yeah, of course. When I first got the opportunity to work with AFP as a photo editor, I accepted it because like I needed a way in a sense, in the field. And I reckoned that, okay, as a photo editor, I'd be able to learn what actually the clients like and how the entire process works, because like every photojournalist need an editor and they work together. It's a group work. Rarely you'd find the photographers who are editing their work by themselves. So I was like, okay, this is my opportunity to learn more. And maybe once I'm in, I can push to go on assignments. And that's exactly what happened. I kept pushing. I wanted to go. And I got the opportunity to work on different stuff, but never in Lebanon. I was never sent to Lebanon. So when October 7 happened, we didn't really have an expectation of how things would be escalating. When I first arrived to Lebanon in general, I didn't feel scared as if there is a war or anything. I felt very comfortable. In my opinion, things in Lebanon escalated after we were attacked directly. And from there, things at the border got a bit more intense than before.
So before we get to the attack itself and the aftermath, you're pushing to be on the front line and people are telling you no. And I'm going to guess it's not just professional voices, it's friends and family that are saying no, but you're saying yes and you make it happen. So the mindset of you wanting to be in the South, just take me there a bit. You're doing something which I think is noble. You're taking a break from photo editing in Cyprus to be a photojournalist, which I think is closer to your calling. But you're the reason why you're going to the South. No one else is. It's you.
Yeah.
So just why you're persistent in being there?
I just wanted to prove that I can do it. Like, I felt like after working for 5 years with the AFP, it's time for me to actually be sent on such an assignment. I proved myself enough already, and I worked really hard. In journalism, you usually don't get sent on assignments like this unless you've had the training, you've had the experience, you proved yourself already. So I felt like after 5 years and being sent on different assignments and doing all the work necessary, it's time for me to be covering clashes or war in a sense. So I'm not sure why I was super insisting on that. I just wanted to be a war correspondent. I was fascinated by that word. I wanted my photos to play a role in history in some way. Even if, like, not every photo will play a role, but at some point documenting such big events and a war, like, will actually shape history. Do I regret my decision? Of course not. I don't regret it. Even the moment I opened my eyes, I was like, I don't regret it. Like, but the only thing, when we actually take such career decisions, we don't really think about the consequences and how it will affect people around us. Mm. The only thing that hurts me a lot right now, it's the hurt that I see, it's the pain that I see in everyone's eyes around me, like in either friends, family, everyone. I know exactly how painful it was for them to watch me live on TV suffer, or the nerve-wracking experience of every day if she's going to make it or not. I mean, yeah, I am surrounded by an amazing support system, but this support system also suffered a lot. And it's the only thing right now that might actually make me reconsider such decisions, at least for the meanwhile. But yeah.
I want to just maybe, with your permission, the way I saw you roll in was hilarious. It, what is that, like a tank that brought you here?
Yeah.
Bigger than Alia's. And then you look like a gangster coming out, you know, with all the support. I thought bodyguards.
Yeah. No, they're my friends. They're amazing.
Yeah, so that, you have good friends.
Yeah.
That's a very cool entrance. You're within a week of October 7. You're permanently part of the story on the Lebanese side. It's less than a week after October 7 starts. With your permission, if you can take me back to the morning of October 13, you're with friends. You're not just with Isam and Dylan, other colleagues too. And I know this because you shared this with me before, that it was a jovial morning. And I hope I heard this right, that you were, in a way, maybe jovial is not the right word. It was light. There was warmth among friends. And there's war in the background. Some of that video footage that's been shared, you see war in the background, and you see friends as well, sometimes laughing as well. So that morning, can you describe the feeling of being with friends before this all changes for you?
Yeah, it was a very, very calm day. We started in a really cool road trip with Dylan. We were stopped at every army position asking us for our documents. And at some point, I felt so bored. I was texting my colleagues in Nicosia. I'm like, why did you even send me here? It's so boring. There's nothing happening. What are we supposed to do? Can we leave? Like, you know, because we weren't doing anything. We were just waiting for something to happen. And it was getting dark.
So you were there the whole day?
Yeah. We've been there. We've been in the south the entire day. And we were supposed to stay in Tyre more. So, yeah, it was a very, very chill vibe until we heard there's bombardment in the village near us. And we all moved together, Reuters, AFP, Al Jazeera, everyone. The general mood was we felt safe. It wasn't dangerous in any way. For so many reasons, basically because we took all the safety measures, we were in a very exposed area, we were all wearing helmets, and there was drones monitoring us the entire time, from the morning until the evening. So in a sense, we felt like, okay, they know we're here, they know we're covering. None of us expected that something bad will happen.
I know this from Reporters Without Borders. And I think it's Dylan that mentions seeing the drones fly over some 11 times and that there's an Apache helicopter as well above. So that's the day turning to night. I'm sorry to bring up what is going to be the hardest thing I probably have discussed on this podcast. One of the hardest moments for me. The moment you realize what happened, as much as you can say.
Honestly, when the attack happened, I didn't really understand what happened. All I know is that I lost sensation in my leg and Dylan rushing over to help me. So it was a bit chaotic, you know, like when it's all hazy, chaotic. And within it was a matter of seconds until the second attack. So we didn't really register or process what happened exactly. And when the second attack happened, basically everyone else got injured. So I was calling for help and there was no one. and the car, Al Jazeera car, was burning beside me. So it was either I just let myself there and burn to death, or I do something. So I crawled away from the fire to save myself. It was until I saw someone wearing white. I had no idea who that person was. It was Robert from LBC. I waved at him, and in my head, I'm just like, please, please, please don't be an asshole and come save us. So he rushed. Once he rushed over, he was like, okay, I can't carry you. I will need to drag you. So don't, please don't hate me. I'm like, yeah, do whatever. I saw the injuries in my legs, but I didn't know to what extent the damage was. So, and while he's dragging me to a safe spot, my entire focus and concern was the camera bag with the lenses. And I'm like, hey, please, can you get me the lens bag? And he was like, fuck the lens bag. Like, what are you talking about? So afterwards, like, the camera was suffocating me in a way. So I have no idea how or why. I asked him to keep the camera with him. I had no idea who is this person. Just felt like, okay, I'm going to see him next. Like, just once we're done with this shit, I'm going to see him and take my camera again. Again, clueless. I have no idea.
Sorry, this is Isam's camera.
No, it's my camera.
It's your camera.
Yeah, it's the one I was wearing.
Is that the one Isam gave you?
It's the one Isam bought it with him from Cyprus. I gave him the money and he got me the camera because it's cheaper here in Lebanon. So, yeah, like my entire concern was the camera, the bag. Like, at that moment, I didn't really understand how severe everything was or how serious everything was. Yeah, so and fast forward, I closed my eyes to one reality, and 12 days later, I opened them to a completely different reality.
So there's a pause from the attack to the hospital bed.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a self-induced, is that correct? Self-induced?
I was sedated and intubated, in the
incubated,
ICU.
For
12 days, because they were trying to save my legs. And the doctors were incredible, honestly. But because the moment I reached the AUH, I lost a lot of blood, and my blood pressure was 5. So basically, if it wasn't for the amazing doctors and for technology, I would have lost my life. I needed a lot of blood units, and they kept operating on me for 12 days, trying to save my right leg before they took the decision to amputate it because it was becoming dangerous and life-threatening. But all of that, it was happening while I was sedated, so I had no idea what's happening. The moment I woke up, I was super angry, and I wanted to leave. I didn't want to stay in the hospital bed. So I was screaming at everyone. I wanted the wheelchair. But keep in mind, I had no voice because of the tube. So no one really...
Right.
Yeah.
Incubation, you can't... Yeah.
So no one really understood what I was asking for. At first, I thought that I lost both legs. So when I found out that it was only one, I texted everyone. And I was celebrating. Oh, okay, there's one more leg left. It's weird. It's a horrific, horrible experience. When I woke up, I wasn't in the best mental state. I had severe PTSD. I couldn't see blood. I thought there's war, and I was scared.
That's what I wanted to ask you. When you woke up, did you feel like you were still there? Or were you aware that this was past? Because I can imagine you're coming out of a coma and it's just...
It's in the hospital. Yeah, yeah. Like,
you wouldn't necessarily know where you are.
I understood that I am in a hospital, but I just didn't understand exactly how severe the situation was.
Yeah.
And what happened in the 12 days.
Right.
It was a bit chaotic for me. I couldn't sleep for 5 days. I was scared that any slap or anything would remind me that of bombing and attacks.
Yeah.
So severe PTSD until they gave me medicines to help me overcome my anxiety and my PTSD and to make me to be able to sleep because you need to sleep. Like, yeah.
I can imagine that the feeling of real anger and rage comes later, not at that moment. But you're screaming already and you're obviously letting it out. So those 5 days where you finally, let's say, begin to digest what happened, as much as you can say about that.
No, I woke up super angry. I woke up boiling with rage because I knew, I was aware that we were attacked. I was so angry. And in a way, at that moment, I wished I died because I didn't want to go through what I was going through. It was too painful. So it wasn't until I found out that Hisam died and my entire perspective changed. Because I didn't know at first. I found out after a nurse asked me who died, and I had to Google. And that's the first thing I saw. It's his funeral, and I lost it. So...
Sorry, you Googled because they weren't telling you?
Yeah, no one told me, and I didn't have my phone. I didn't have my laptop. I had no connection to the outside world. I had no idea what's happening. It wasn't until the day I received everything and I was showing the nurses my work. One of them asked me who died and I had to Google it. And that's how I found out. And yeah, it wasn't the pleasant day, the most pleasant day ever. Because basically he took all the impact and that's what saved me. If it was 1 millimeter difference between us, I would have died as well. So the thought of losing a friend but you surviving really messes you up. But it gives you also the power, because Hisam, if he was still with us, he wouldn't want me to give up. And yeah, it gave me the power to keep fighting every day for the next 5 months. And in my head, I still haven't accepted that Hisam, we lost Hisam. He's still here somewhere with us.
I'll share something personal since you're opening up. You said you went to your phone because you didn't believe what people were saying. Not to make this about me, but I'll open up a bit. That's what I did when my father died. I didn't believe what other people were saying. Somebody came to my door and said, call your mom. And I didn't know what she was talking about. And then she turned off the TV. I'm like, these are signals that something is wrong. And I went to my phone, did the same thing as you. I Googled. So that Google thing. Yeah. I think it's what you've gone through is far more personal and it has left you physically scarred. I don't want to either pretend like I know what you've been through, but that search is familiar. You want to know yourself.
Yeah, it definitely messes you up. It's not the best way to find out that someone really close to you has died. It's shocking. It all feels surreal, honestly. Ever since I woke up, I feel like I'm stuck in a parallel universe. And I don't know how to explain that to people. I'm here, but I'm not here at the same time. I'm experiencing everything from a third perspective, from an outside, as an outsider. It doesn't feel like this is my life. I'm still surrounded by the same people and all the familiar stuff that I know and I grew up to, but I'm not connected to my mind or my body. I'm just kicking in and fighting until the moment I can get back something out of my previous life. I don't know if it makes sense.
No, I think a photojournalist never wants to be the photo.
Of course. We never want to be... the subject we're reporting on, and that's the thing. What do we do when we become the story?
Yeah.
That we are meant to report on. What do we do then? Like, it's crazy. I never imagined. I always thought that I would be known, recognized for my work behind the camera. I never thought that people will get to know me based on what they saw on the TV or after hearing my screams. And yeah, I would have loved not if people got to know me in different circumstances and for my work to get this recognition.
I'll go slightly parallel to this. The feeling of false comfort, which I think resonates with all of us in different ways. You're in Cyprus. This is your home. With or without war, there's a feeling of, I think, relative safety that could be a bit delusional. Did that go through your mind in the last 5-6 months where you realize that this feeling, which I have, I think all of us have it, that have been impacted in different ways, that that is real? It is a false comfort. Has there been any thoughts about that, that your career and what you do is implicitly life-threatening, but you feel better? It's that comfort that's still here.
I mean, I guess like every journalist, when they decide to become journalists, you're aware that there is a big risk of something bad happening to you. You're always, it's always in the back of your head. You can't really escape it. You're always aware. And with Lebanon, I always had this love-hate relationship. I always knew it's not a secure place just to exist as a human, let alone as a journalist.
Right, exactly.
So,
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's a very messed up place, unfortunately, even though we all love it. But at that day, at that moment, I was not scared in any way. I felt like, okay, fine, we're not in the middle of the action. We're on the sides. And you should be considerably in a safe zone. I didn't expect in any way or shape that we will be targeted and my entire life will be changed and I will be stuck here in Cyprus, in Lebanon for the 6 months, for the next 6 months. So yeah, I did not expect that in any way, even though I always knew Lebanon was not a safe place.
I think all of us have that feeling, and I'm glad you said that it impacts everybody, even when they're not looking for it, it hurts us too. But you've had something which is unusual, I think, is that we've all witnessed it together, and that Reuters did produce, or there is an investigation with a report to a degree that explains what happened. So we know what Israel did, and we know that that's the story, and it's accessible for all of us. I don't know if this is the right word to use here, but do you feel some resolution with that kind of work, that kind of investigation? Does it bring any closure at all? Not just, clearly not just for Issam Abdullah, but for everyone that was hurt and injured. Is there any feeling there of closure?
Not necessarily, no. We knew from the first moment that we were attacked by Israel. I mean, who else will attack you with two Merkava shells and machine gun afterwards? Like, so we knew from the start, and definitely there was no closure. If anything, every time there's a new investigation, it triggers us and it opens up all the wounds, and we go through this roller coaster of emotions, of understanding and reliving every moment. Because what if we miss something?
Yeah.
Something important that can actually give us closure. So no, but especially also that you know deep down that there will never be justice. I mean, how to get justice against from Israel? You get what I mean? From a country specifically. We weren't the first nor the last journalists that are and still attacked to this day. I mean, we lost so many colleagues in the field in Gaza, everywhere.
I think it's Dylan's words as well in that Reporters Without Borders video that it's a war that's had the most journalist casualties documented, at least in history. So what could that look like to you? What would closure look like to you?
I said it before and I will say it again. I want to know the face. I want to know the name of who was behind the attack. Like, who was the guy sitting in this Merkava tank and chose to press the button and, yeah, basically changed our entire lives? I want to know who. I mean, in every crime, you know, who was behind it, no? We were like, yeah. We know it's the IDF, but who exactly?
My knowledge on the UN's work is limited. Is there any sense that that will be accessible through a more robust investigation, whether it's through UNIFIL, whether it's through another body? Is there an inclination there that this information will be made public, or is it sort of accepted that it doesn't happen?
We hope so. We've been asking for it. We hope it will be made public. We hope all these investigations will be one day used to get us justice. In any way, I mean, I'd be more than happy. But realistically, if I'm a very realistic person, realistically, I know for a fact, at least for the meanwhile, there won't be any kind of justice.
Do you see yourself going back to a front line? Do you still think Patrick is wrong? Do you want to pursue what you've been doing despite this injury?
I mean, I guess it's too early to say that right now, but deep down, yeah, I want to go back and I want to be running on every border, not only the Lebanese-Israeli border. I want to be running on every border because like I didn't lose my leg to be back on a desk job. I want to be covering what's happening. That was my passion from the start. Like, I won't let Israel stop me just because they decided to target me.
That's a great slogan against desk jobs.
So, yeah, I wanna go back to the field. Not necessarily maybe at first to the front line because I don't want my friends and family to suffer that soon. So maybe later on in my career, but yeah, definitely I miss it. I miss being behind the camera. I miss running. I miss walking. Just it all feels weird right now to me. So yeah, hopefully one day.
Another point to ask you, and this is something you mentioned to me, which wouldn't have crossed my mind. So I'm glad you mentioned it. 6 months of being more or less stuck physically. Perhaps more dependent on people than you'd like to be, under constant attention and scrutiny, can drive anyone insane. But you seem to be fine. More or less, you're fine. You're more than fine. I mean, you're shining. So how do you explain that? Coping with, I think, which is more a mental situation, less physical. Your mental state and managing to pull through.
Honestly, I have no idea. I'm trying my best every day, but I feel like when you go through something as traumatic and life-changing, you have two options. Either you give up on yourself and you accept the fact that, okay, now I'm a victim and that's it, or you turn your anger into something positive and you make it your fuel to keep pushing. Because deep down, I know one day I'm going to be walking again and I will stand up. And that's my, in a sense, that's how I will win over Israel and what happened. So, yeah, as traumatic as it is, you try to process it as much as you can. And I haven't processed it fully, what happened. I'm still trying to do that. But, yeah, definitely you turn your anger and you keep pushing. And you use it for something beneficial. It's like, there's no point of just giving up on yourself. There's no choice. You have to push. You have to go. The only way through is in, I think. That's the quote. The only way through is to go in, to go through what's happening, and to feel the pain, to feel the anger, to experience everything, to cry. We cry a lot. We have lots of crying sessions. But, yeah. And hope that eventually you will win. You will win this battle. You will win this fight. And you will be walking again.
There's more I will ask you during the Q&A. And obviously the audience will get the chance to ask their questions. You know, I can't say it enough. It is a privilege to speak to you tonight. And thank you for doing this with me. Let's take a 10-minute pause. The audience can order whatever they'd like. And in 10 minutes, we'll open it up to Q&A.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Christina. Before we start the Q&A, I'm going to make fun of Christina one more time. We had thought about putting a guest list for the episode that was gender specific, sexy men only. I think we both decided against that.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask one more question before giving the audience the mic. I think it's okay to ask this because it's still in progress, and you've been a bit public about it. The physical recovery and what exactly will happen. Is it a bionic leg? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Bionic. When I hear that, I hear superpowers. Like you can laser beam things out of your leg.
Sure, why not?
What is it? What is the process like? Will you have to travel?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, basically now we need to wait before putting any prothèse for now.
Just bring the mic a little closer to you.
Yeah, we will have to wait for now until all my wounds are full on healed. And yeah, afterwards I will move to France for rehabilitation and for the prothèse. But it's in the summer, it's not anytime soon. So... yeah, for now it's just physio, getting my muscles back because I lost all my muscle mass. And yeah, getting in shape and stronger in order to be able to, yeah, to wear the prothèse and do the rehabilitation.
Physical therapy, you have to live in France for that.
The rehabilitation process, that's what the agency is offering. For the meantime, I'm doing physiotherapy on a daily basis. So yeah, just preparing for the rehabilitation phase where I will be doing intensive workout and exercise and we will be preparing the prothèse and getting used to walking on it. And it's not only my amputated leg, my left leg is also severely damaged with a fixator. So yeah, it's both legs basically. So it's a long, long way to recovery.
And roughly how long do you imagine being in France? Is this years?
I mean, basically, I'm going to go to France and just move there.
I see.
Yeah.
So that will become home. France will become home.
Yeah. Just because I will be doing my rehabilitation and my doctor will be there. So the best decision is to stay there for at least a few years just to get, adapt to this new life and to the new leg, robotic leg.
Robotic leg.
Yeah. Yeah, basically everything was snatched from me my entire life. I left my house in Cyprus, which was supposedly for 3 days or 1 week tops. And now we're talking about moving to a completely new country with and doing the rehabilitation and getting used to everything, to this new life, to the new leg, bionic leg. Yeah, it's absurd.
You know, it's also an occasion to maybe do one more round of applause because there's somebody who joined. Well, yes, for you, Christina, of course.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, that's nice because they gave it to you, yeah. But I was going to give it to someone else. Yeah. Somebody who joined in, I think, towards the end of the discussion, Eli Brachia. There he is at the door. Dylan can attribute it to, I was about to pat him on the shoulder, and he's like, "La!" That was a nice moment we had outside. So guys, whoever's in the back behind the door, just walk to the front for the Q&A. A mic will be provided. For those closer, just stand up and we'll pass the mics around. Just a show of hands if anyone wants to ask something up front before I put people on the spot. Oh, the gentleman's sitting in the front. So let's bring the mic to him. And just stand up if you could and introduce yourself. Yeah, so we can have a better shot of you.
I'm Charlie. I want to know if your sense of humor was before the accident or came after.
It was always a dark humor. It became much more intense now. I joke a lot about my leg, so and my friends don't like it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The gentleman sitting at the bar.
Thank you so much, Christina, for speaking with us today and for your bravery. What do you think the message is from the Israelis after they launched this cowardly strike, killing Issam, injuring you, and then also with their strike on the World Central Kitchen workers in Gaza, which we haven't seen a full investigation yet, but I think it's pretty safe to say that was intentional. I personally believe it was. What's the message to journalists, to aid workers, to people who want to do work in the field? Why would Israel do this?
The only realistic answer would be it's to silence us. They're definitely trying to silence journalists. They don't want anyone to be covering or helping in this war or to bear witness. So, I mean, all the investigations showed that it was also a targeted attack and we were definitely targeted. There's no doubts in that. So, yeah, my only realistic understanding or explanation to why this happened is because they wanted to silence us and they didn't want us to be there.
You were saying in the conversation that there certainly won't be any accountability, not in the short term. As a journalist myself, I do know that there's been a very chilling, this strike had a very chilling effect in the industry. People are very scared to go to southern Lebanon. But do you think that over time, people will recognize the strike for what it was? And do you think that Israel maybe could have miscalculated and that the intimidation isn't worth the cost to Israel's reputation in the long term? Do you think that eventually that could turn against them?
I guess it's already turning against them, given that what we've been witnessing. Narrative or perspective of the people regarding what's happened, like Israel's position in the world and in politics, it's changing completely. And even the Westerns who aren't really receiving daily updates, they're definitely like the perspective and point of view is shifting against Israel for sure.
The lady in the middle, thanks for standing.
Aysam's cousin.
Oh, it's Aysam's cousin.
Yeah. Yes. Hello, everyone. So my name is Miriam. I'm the family of Aysam. First of all, before I ask my question, I just want to say that the moment we lost Aysam, while we were, grieving and going downwards, Christina gave us a lot of life and patience because the fact that they were so close as friends and she was standing next to him and she was still there. There was a flower that was still living. We were really waiting for her to wake up. We even visited her hospital multiple times. So thank you for giving us strength. Islam lives within you through us. It's so important for us. You being a woman in particular. Islam respected women so much, and I'm sure you know that, and supported them. So that's as a start. Thank you, Christina, for being who you are. So honest, so transparent, not using any of your story for any. So real, authentic. Thank you for being that. My question actually kind of continues through the gentleman over here. You know, after that war, in particular, journalism came back again very strongly because of how much journalists passed away and got injured. Like people, this new generation haven't heard of, or we've heard of them, like my age, but not younger. Like Rachel Corrie, like, you know, people that died long time ago that we thought their stories were gone. Today, the new generation are bringing back those stories. People are talking about those heroes, those journalists that people forgot about. So do you think in that little light in the journalist stories that are bringing back again, there is a path to a change in perspective, which you've already said, but in journalism in particular, as a power and a force to take over such an enemy and such a, you know, an enemy like Israel, not in all the ways we see it in wars, which people have conflicting politics about, but actually through messages and strong people and heroes like you, Christina. That's really my question.
Thank you, Miriam. So much love for you and Islam's family, for sure. I mean, I hope, I really, really hope and wish that one day all the journalists and the journalistic body would unite together against the atrocities that journalists are facing in this war in particular. And I really, really hope that, yeah, one day we will see everyone standing together and we'd be able to achieve a better environment for aspiring journalists, that's for sure. I hope so.
The gentleman way in the back.
I'm a journalist as well, and there's many journalists here. Is there anything you would... It's maybe two things. Is there anything you would like, in our choices of our work, would advise us after what you've been through? And like, you don't want to be on the other side of the camera. But do you still, like, would you expect from the press here to cover your story and your colleagues more? Is it something you want more attention to, or that you want less attention to? The personal perspective is different than, but yeah, I'm wondering, like, what do you think is better?
Well, to start, my message will always be to all photographers, don't risk your life for a story. It's not worth it. Don't risk it. And the second part is that I'm not sure it's conflicting, honestly. And every day I ask myself, is it something that I want to keep doing or not? I mean, basically, we took all the safety measurements when we were there. We did everything right, but yet we were targeted. So I'm not sure if there is anything that can protect us, given that there are already international laws to protect journalists on their duty. But yeah, was it worth it? Was it worth it? All the loss, the pain, the heartbreak. Yeah, of course, it's always worth it. We have a duty, and when we chose this career, we knew from the start that there will be a loss and a risk in every day. So my only message to all journalists covering the war is to take care of each other and be there for each other. And of course, like, share their stories, support, and be the voice for those who can't really express in words.
Thank you.
I'm going to put a friend of mine on the spot. This lady sitting in the middle, Julia Cingolani, she was disappointed that the discussion was too short. And I think she has many questions to ask, so she gets the microphone. Just stand up. Let's give the microphone to Julia.
Thank
stand
you.
Up. Embarrass yourself more. Yeah.
Hello. Nice to meet you. Thanks, Ronnie.
My pleasure.
For always putting me in the middle of the light. So you said, as an advice for everybody, for journalists, you said, don't risk your life. Do you feel that you did it? Do you feel like if you came back, if you could come back, would you do that again? Wouldn't you do that again?
I would definitely do it again. Definitely. Like even now, I would definitely go if I can. But yeah, like it will never stop me. And I think it's mutual to all journalists who are targeted in a way. Yeah, of course, the feelings vary. Like we don't all feel the same or go through the same thing exactly. But there is something that keeps kicking in from within and keeps telling you that don't stop, don't stop. And if anything, the target made me more persisting and yeah, that I want to continue in this career.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Please. It's not a question.
Just bring the microphone closer. Thanks.
I don't like being in front of the camera nor speaking out loud in front of people. So it's going to take some time. Isam and me were very close. It's the first time I see you since. All I want to say is thank you. Thank you for your strength. Staying positive, laughing, and making us laugh. Me as a visual journalist, who could have been there? I wish I would have met you differently. But you definitely are an example to me and to make me keep going forward.
Thank you. You made me tear up, but thank you.
You've done something very powerful, which is, I think, extremely difficult to accomplish unless it happens under your circumstance. You're in the middle of a battlefield by choice, by passion and pursuit. You're there with friends who are doing the same thing. All of you are documenting a battle that's beyond your control. You're helping us witness crimes being committed in this country. And you happen to be there throughout the day, not realizing that at the last second, you have power. That attack, the fact that all of you were there, you did two things. You showed us exactly what's going on, and you proved once and for all that Israel can be held accountable. That's an amazing accomplishment, and it's an unexpected one. And I know that you want to know the names. Clearly, you want to know everything. But the fact is, it's been proven that wearing your press outfit, being clearly marked as journalists, is not enough. The Israelis targeted you deliberately. And you found a way, although this is maybe too fresh, you found a way at exposing what they did. So I think that is a gift to many people searching for accountability in this very old tragedy in this country. You did it. That's less a question, more a comment.
Yeah. Thank you, Ronnie. Thank you. I guess, yeah. I mean, if there's anything that made people get touched by what happened because they watched it live on TV. So it wasn't only, journalists being attacked. It was also seeing a young person trying their best to save their lives or also screaming because of pain or whatever. So it was very sentimental and emotional because people watched it live on TV.
Yeah.
And I think that's why they were affected. And there are still, I received thousands of messages from people around the world praying for me in all different languages and all religions. And it was very, very heartwarming because like you wouldn't expect that. You definitely wouldn't expect that. So yeah, I feel like people got affected by what happened, not only because journalists were attacked, because like they were seeing it live on TV.
Yeah.
The suffering, the pain, the tragedy. So.
I wanted to ask about the psychological healing and getting through those things, because obviously those things can be harder than the physical things. I'm someone who benefited from very good therapy for some PTSD things in the past, and learned the value of family and those people around you. And I wondered if you could talk about any of those things that help you to heal psychologically.
Yeah. I'm still in the process, but of course, having an amazing, amazing support system helps a lot. And if it wasn't for my friends, family, I wouldn't be sitting here sharing my story today. It's because of them and making things easy for me and helping me when needed that gave me the strength to be here. So yeah, the trauma, the PTSD, it's very heavy, and it will take a lot of time to heal from such a traumatic event. And I'm not sure if we will ever heal completely. It's a major turning point in our life. But I think with time we will adapt, and we will find ways to live with this trauma and horrific event.
So I'm going to impose a question on Dylan and Eli. I can't see them from here. I think Dylan is seated. Eli is standing. So let's get the microphones to Dylan and Eli. I'm going to put you both on the spot. It's a shared experience. Thanks.
Good evening.
Thank you, Dylan. Just to maybe push a bit. It's a shared experience. Yourself, Eli. Christina, you were there together. And if there's anything you can add, maybe something I'm not focusing on that I should, about that moment and how you've handled it and moved on.
I would just, I was wondering if you remember the first words that you said to me when you woke up in the hospital 12 days later?
That it's just the leg.
She whispers, she has, her voice is super hoarse. She's been intubated for 2 weeks, and she whispers, she calls me closer to her, and she goes, "It's okay, it's just one leg." So
yeah,
even just like the first couple minutes after you woke up, you still had your humor.
Yeah.
And I thank you for that, because it's helped me get through all of this as well.
Thank you.
If you share the stories, it will take more 1 hour. So let's keep it simple. I know like 90% of your answers, I already know it. I have a small question. Who did your makeup?
Who did my makeup? I did it. Why?
Masma.
Anna.
Ah, good. This is the first time I see you with makeup. But it's good. It's looking good.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, you're used to see me in a blood pool of blood and yeah, with no leg. Yeah.
Now I saw you one day before. You know, you remember the first time I met you.
It was, I still had both legs
before the assault. So you were talking. Then the next day we saw her. They joined us, and you were like full nature. Yeah.
I see the humor is shared on the battlefield. Everyone's just making jokes.
Yeah, of course. It's the only way to process something like that. You can't not make jokes about it. Like yeah. It's too much for the mind. It's too much.
Yeah.
You can't. The only way is to joke about it and yeah, make fun of it. Make fun of our pain, basically. It's super painful. Don't just because we're laughing today doesn't mean we're sleeping well, we're eating well, we're happy and everything is fine. No, we're not okay, we're not fine, but we're trying our best and we're there for each other, because there was a bond, even though we collectively experienced something as traumatic and tragic, there was a really strong bond that was created after this attack. I mean, now Eli, Dylan, their family, They're not just colleagues on the field. There's blood between us, and it's as much as I try to explain our bond or our relationship. No words can express can do justice to our friendship or relationship.
I remember messaging you, Dylan, when you were injured in Ukraine, and you replied when you could, and then when the attack happened, I didn't want a message. And I was so relieved to see that you survived. That's my relationship to what you've been through. But it was something that I never imagined. These kinds of people that you see regularly disappearing. And as Isam's cousin said, I think you've kept him alive. All of you have kept him alive in your own way. But by committing yourself to the profession, departure to France or otherwise, I think that's the story.
Yeah, Isam will forever be with us in every assignment, every ride even. Like, we used to go on rides to share food. He will basically, his memory will always be living with us and through us. I think in our profession, we will keep losing people we love, very dear people to us. It's not only now, even for later. And that's also part of our mission. We lose a lot. There's a lot of heartbreak and pain.
And that pain is all over this country. You even said it yourself, at the age of 9, an inspiration for your career is the murder of a politician. That sets your own trajectory.
Yeah, so, having lived the war, having lived the unstable, the chaos in a sense, definitely shaped who I am today and how I handle traumatic events. Hopefully I won't suffer anymore. Like, one is enough for now. So
we have time for one more question and then we can wrap it up. Yes, please. Or a comment, sure.
Hi. Thank you so much for sharing your bravery and your story. I just wanted to thank you for reporting what you report, yourself and the other independent reporters here. I live in Canada where the news is banned on social media and I don't have television. So now I was in Canada in October when the conflict broke out here. And you and all of you reporting here are the only way that I was able to see anything, to even know what was going on. So thank you for that, for thank all you. That you do and for sharing, and your strength is...
Thank you.
It's please just something else. No, it's amazing. Good luck in your career and your own. Thank you for all of you who are... I follow you on Instagram. You don't know who I am, but I see the news via you.
Thank you. Means thanks. A lot.
Thank you.
So I'll wrap it up. I know that you want to be a documentary filmmaker. That's still inside you.
Yeah.
I hope that time in France allows the beginning of what should be, I think, a masterpiece once it's ready. You've told me a bit about what you have in mind. I think the story is there. So I look forward to watching that when it happens. Let me ask a final question. Patrick told you, don't do it. A younger photography-inclined journalist comes to you 10 years from now and asks you the same thing you asked Patrick. What do you say?
Don't do it. Don't do it. It's not worth it.
And then that person goes ahead
and they will do it. So yeah, there is no escape in that. You'd advise someone. I mean, Patrick was a great support ever since the day one, and he always guided me in a sense. But no matter how much you tell someone don't do it or don't do something, they will do it if they wanted to. So you just advise, you guide them, you give the necessary tools in a way, and share your experience and hope that maybe one day it will change their decision or affect them in any way possible. I don't know. By just sharing my story and my work even for later on, I hope it really does make a change and aspire other younger journalists.
To the journalists, photojournalists, desk editors, and field war correspondents, thank you for letting me do this with you, Christina. It's a highlight of my very strange career in storytelling in Lebanon. I'll never forget this night.
Thank you, Roni. Thank you for having me. Thank you, everyone.
Not bad, huh?
Thank you.
So guys, it's at the Beirut Banyan on social media to see upcoming guests. This episode will take some time to properly put together, but I guarantee it'll be the right way of looking back at this occasion. I'll filter myself. You have makeup, so you're fine. Thanks, Eli. I should get your makeup next time.
Anytime.
And if you want to stick around at Alia's, I guess the martini discount extends through the night, and they have obviously other options as well. Thanks to Rayan, Alexi, and everyone for joining tonight. Good night.
Thank you.